grandfather tell me how it was when you were young? Was the world so very old when your life had just begun?
Good afternoon and welcome to Living Permaculture on KDNK. I'm Vanessa Harmony of Colorado Edible Forest in Glenwood Springs, Colorado, joined by my co-host Jerome Osentowski of Central Rocky Mountain Permaculture Institute, or CRIMPI, in Basalt, Colorado. On today's program, we are honored to welcome David Lipsky of New York, New York. David Lipsky is a New York Times best-selling author whose recent nonfiction book is entitled The Parrot and the Igloo, Climate and the Science of Denial. New York Times' Zoe Schlanger describes it in her book review as, David Lipsky spins top-flight climate literature into cliffhanger entertainment. And now for my description. It's a shocking and terrifying account of humankind's roller coaster ride, starting at the invention of the telegraph, the light bulb, and electrical current, to the shockwave of inventions and consumer products those created, to the voices of science and reason that pleaded in the ears of society and politicians to take action against the negative impacts industry was having on human health and climate, and the sociopathic greed of naysaying bullies who built a culture of clouding the truth by sullying scientists' reputations and creating false self-serving mimics of the truth. And finally, the heart-sinking anticlimax when climate change scientists finally achieve redemption and affirmation, but human weaknesses either obstruct or belittle or skirt opportunities to take meaningful action. I wish I could say I was spoiling the ending there, but we're all here living and breathing and listening in our current reality. So now I'm going to reach deep inside to pull out my positivity and optimism and offer David Lipsky a warm welcome to our program. David, thank you for being with us.
Vanessa, Jerome, thanks for having me.
Did that sound familiar? That's because that was a re-airing of the introduction of last month's episode of our interview with David Lipsky. Following is part two of mine and Jerome's conversation with New York Times bestselling author David Lipsky. Enjoy! Going back to the more exciting and romantic beginning part of the book, I really enjoyed how you painted humanizing details into all of your quote-unquote characters. So it was very enlightening to learn about Samuel Morse and Thomas Edison and Nikola Tesla. And when I was reading it, I kind of thought, well, why are we starting all the way back here? But then, of course, by the end, the origins of modern technology became an important underlying theme for the entire book. And then Thomas Edison's light bulb had a very disheartening cameo in part three. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it was. We're living in an interesting, strange time. One of the weird things is that the deniers, and I don't think that we do, those of us who understand how this particular equation works, we're stuck with a certain dialogue that doesn't really benefit us. So when we say the science, I think that people who don't agree yet, they perceive it as bullying. And when we call the people who disagree deniers, we are borrowing some of the rhetorical power from the terrible history of that word. And I think people whose agreement it would be useful for us to win, I think they feel pushed around by that as well. Because in general, what the deniers, if I can just use the phrase right. again, what they wanted, what they would officially say is, look, we're not saying this isn't true. What we're saying is, let's ask ourselves, how good a deal are we getting from fossil fuels? And maybe we just want to roll the dice and see where this takes us. The weird thing is that that's the decision that we've reached. Like, I was talking to a fellow journalist this afternoon, and the giant denial movements, they all kind of collapsed. There was like a colony collapse is what they would use for butterflies or bees. There was a colony collapse on their side. Like, no, there aren't scientists making the case anymore because the weather basically is making the opposite case every season. But their basic hope, which is, would we, in a weird way, without saying it, would we decide to just roll the dice and keep accepting this really good deal? Please just think about it before you act precipitously. In a weird way, that is the decision that we've made. And I don't know if this is how you experience the world, both on this issue, but in general, it seems like that most of the actions that we take on almost any of the issues that bedevil us as a country, they tend to be symbolic. So I love the way you describe the book. It is, for the scientists, it was a huge, terrible fight. It was like Star Wars, or it was like some sports movie where you are fighting your way from the basement of the standings, you know, into a positive win-loss thing, and then you find your way into the playoffs, and then you win your division championship, and then you're in the Super Bowl. And against all these odds, in 2007, after fighting against bad, you know, obstructionist presidents, against obstructionist chiefs of staff, then against the second President Bush, who did not care what his father's policy was, the headline while he was president about his relation to climate change, the headline in the Times was the President Bush versus the laureates. Mm-hmm. And he basically won. Like, he fought them to a standstill. He wouldn't publish their results. People like Jim Hansen at NASA were threatened about presenting their results on radio. Finally, in 2007, the IPCC, which is, you know, the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they had been tasked in the late 80s, and they were welcomed by the first President Bush's Secretary of State, Jim Baker, who said, hey, you know, we're all in the same boat, and Godspeed. That was before his chief of staff, Sununu, got in the way, basically. Took them 20 years to do what the National Academy of Sciences did in the late 70s to say, okay, we've looked at all the evidence. Here is the definitive answer. Here is the unequivocal answer. Climate change is caused by human beings. Carbon dioxide-driven climate change is arising from human beings. And you could feel the relief of the scientists. Vanessa, you remember from the book, Dr. Richard Alley, who'd given his career to bringing up the records, the atmospheric records from the far past in Greenland by digging out ice cores. He is at the press conference in Paris in February of 2007, and he says, you paid us to do science, and we have high confidence in the science. This is real. This is real. This is real. Now act. The ball's in your court. And that was the same year that the IPCC and former Vice President Al Gore shared the Nobel Prize for their work. And then an even bigger prize, Al Gore won the Academy Award for his documentary about global warming. And so there was all this momentum, and the scientists were so thrilled that there would be action taken. And the action that was taken is that we began to ban the incandescent light bulb.
Womp womp.
It was so surprising to former Vice President Gore that he was at Davos in February of the following year, and he and Tom Friedman of the New York Times, they both said, look, you know, it's about changing laws, not changing light bulbs. They couldn't believe it.
But whatever happened to let's plant more trees? I mean, that's where I'm coming from, is let's do agroforestry, do food forests, and a lot of this problem goes away. I mean, that's proven, too, with trees sequestering carbon and doing carbon farming. I think that
absolutely. And Jerome, one of the interesting things is right in that first blush. So by 1961, the Times said this is how much of a head start we were given. And I don't think we did a great job with it. We thought we were Achilles. It turned out we were the tortoise. But in 1959, the incoming head of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science, so it's one of the few groups that can compete with the NAS for prestige, the head of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science, he said, look, just what Jerome is saying, we can plant our way out of this.
Oh, exactly.
And so this was the first officially presented solution. His idea was one tree for every car, 10 trees for every truck or bus, and 100 trees per airplane. And he said, otherwise, we just burn. And we have not taken those actions either. Freeman Dyson is also a great believer in planting new trees.
No, we're constantly cutting down the forest, and we're not replanting it. I've been working in Puerto Rico, and traveling in Costa Rica, it's a disaster zone there. It's industrial tourism, and there's no agroforestry going on. There's just monocropping of crops, spraying, bulldozing. It just goes on and on. None of these ideas that really will work have taken on, because there's no quick buck in that one. You can do agroforestry and make money from the very get-go. The idea of agroforestry is a complex system, and in permaculture we have the principles and ethics, and we can build systems that are almost energy free and inexpensive. We can put them on the ground. I'm working on a 900-acre farm in Puerto Rico now, and it's been devastated for 150 years. So you can't grow anything on it right now, because the only thing that grows is the most useless weeds right now. So if somebody was going to plant something, what they do, they bring a bulldozer in, they would take that off, and they would monocrop another crop of sugarcane or pineapple. But in order to make it work properly, you go in with nitrogen-fixing trees on swales, contours. You grow your fertility and you grow your carbon right on place. You don't have to bring in any fertilizers. There are hundreds of nitrogen-fixing trees and different kinds of plants that build the biomass to create the soils. And then right away, you're putting in your cash crops. So these systems are working in small scales all over the world. But I have not been able to. I do it at my place on 1 acre, but I can't get it. I can't get any traction overseas. And I've been working. I spent 2 years in Nicaragua putting in a demonstration farm, 30 years ago, and it just never went anywhere. So I don't know what it's going to take to get agroforestry and carbon farming up to a scale where it's going to be doing something.
Well, there was a thing, Jerome, that was very interesting to me to learn, and that was such a thought-provoking thing. There was a million ways to respond. It's like being a chess program and seeing the 16 or 17 moves you can make off of the wonderful thing you were saying just now. But here's the basic one, which has to do with how the people that we've elected, even from our side, how they've approached this. A friend of mine who's very committed to this issue, he went down about 10 years ago to work for one of the senators who is most closely associated with the problem of global warming. And this senator is someone who has talked about changing our consumption patterns and changing our waste patterns as a way to begin solving this. My friend who was writing the senator's speeches was very surprised to learn that that was not the way this senator lived at all. Now, that kind of Dickensian hypocrisy wouldn't really be worth our time on this show. It isn't that. What he then learned in working for the senator and seeing the senator talk to other politicians who are allied on the issue is that they don't really believe that personal behavior or large-scale intelligent solutions like the one that you're proposing, that is the way out. What the community, the leadership community in D.C. seems to believe is that there will be some kind of technological fix. And that that helps us understand what's been happening certainly since 2007 and really since the 1980s.
I'd like to give you an example of that, because I grow citrus and I import citrus from California. And, there's a citrus greening disease that's wiped out citrus in California and in Florida. And I was talking to the grower, this gal who grows citrus called the backyard citrus, and I was talking to her about the greening disease, and I was talking to some other scientists down there, and it was obvious what the problem is. It's that they were growing these citrus in burned out soils for 30 or 40 years, spring Roundup, and nothing ever goes into it. And I said, why aren't they going to fix the problem by going and fixing the soil? And she says, no. I've talked to the people at the university, And they said, if we can't patent the fix for greening disease, we don't want anything to do with it. So again, so this is, and this is what I see everywhere in agriculture. It's just, let's destroy this soil. Let's don't put anything back. Let's mine the soil. And it goes on right in this valley, basically. We never put enough back in, into what we're taking out. I'm up on a rock outcropping, so I had to build soils to start with. But if you go down on the valley floor, there's 20 feet of topsoil. So, the ranchers are pretty much just mining the grass, haying, and running their cattle out there. And, the organic growers can hardly keep up with soil fertility because we have a short season here. But we have to rethink the whole thing. It's not growing radishes and carrots. It's an agroforestry system where you can grow 100 different things. It's like they've got to have some imagination, and they don't have it. I don't know what it is, what it's going to take for people to imagine something different. So everything is there. Nature provides everything. And why don't we get it?
But the thing with that, Jerome, the reason that I was snorting a little bit is that is brilliant. Here's the issue, and it comes back to what you were saying about both Nicaragua and Puerto Rico. Those kinds of solutions for the developed world make a great deal of sense, but when we have begun talking about making changes like that in in the developed world, those solutions are acceptable because we have already matured as economies. And so the question is, how can we get some of the things that we're used to, but get it at a smaller cost to the atmosphere or to the natural world? But when we have brought some of those ideas to the developing world, to what used to be called the third world, what they say is, You and Europe and even China, because China and India have been catching up very quickly to the consumption levels in Europe and North America. You guys depended on unrestricted use of carbons, of fossil fuels, as a way to get the tremendous leg up that you have on us economically. And now you are turning to us as we begin to industrialize, and you're telling us that we can't do that. And so you get into very complicated theoretical questions, like, do we have the right to say you have to farm in this much more intelligent way that you're talking about now? You have to farm that way in Africa or in Central and South America when we helped ourselves to unrestricted use of heavily polluting industries, to the point where we are now outgrowing and out-consuming your cultures, and we are not going to allow you to do the same thing. And that has proved to be the devil of a question in international negotiations on this.
Well, I think, we need to do the carbon farming solutions everywhere in the United States, in developing countries, because that model works, whether you're in a backyard garden in Denver or whether you're on a farm in the Aspen Valley or you're in Puerto Rico. All of these carbon farming solutions are applicable to every climate. They're applicable to temperate zones. They're applicable to tropical zones. They're applicable to desert zones. There are techniques and strategies for every possible situation, and we've written about it and practiced it. There are examples everywhere in the world where carbon farming and permaculture strategies have worked.
There is just that is exciting. But one of the when we were talking about the horrible devastation to indigenous forests in Central and South America, one of the answers that, let's say, Brazil will give is we need to clear that region so that we can have factories and industries the way you have them in New York and Denver and London and Lyon. We're just trying to do what you did. Like, you cleared huge numbers of forests you know, across the middle of the United States. And now, just because it's a century and a half later, you are saying we can't do the same thing. There was an amazing, there was a fascinating quote from a professor, a man named Professor Harry Jacoby, I think, at the MIT Business School. And Vanessa, you might remember this from the early part of the book. It was just such a haunting quote. It was very early, because there are thrilling solutions like the ones Jerome is talking about, but there is just everybody's desire to live easily. And there's the fact that fossil fuels and electricity have knit themselves into every aspect of the way people live now. So that I was smiling to myself while I was working on the book to notice that even cigarettes, you know, the people who trained us in how to lie about science, even cigarettes were now an electric thing. Vaping turned cigarettes into an electrical consumption. And then even books are written electrically. They're written on computers. And then some huge portion, I myself almost only read ebooks, so that you have technology and the fossil fuels that are generating our electricity. You have that in almost every second of an earthling's, of an ordinary human being's life.
Right.
And so this professor at MIT in 1995, what he said is, if you were trying to look for a problem that human institutions can't solve, if you were trying to create one, you couldn't find a better one than global warming.
Yeah.
Totally. Well, I knew our time would pass quickly with such a substantial topic. And before we close the program, David, I'll give you an opportunity to share any closing thoughts with our listeners and how they might be able to get in touch with you as well.
My closing thought is just that that we've brought, I love the very commonsensical approach that Jerome was taking to just the agricultural side to this, the growing side. I think that we have also brought in morality to this, which is that people like us who understand how this equation works, which is carbon dioxide, as you increase it, it traps more of the heat. And then that creates add-on things which make the heat accumulate even faster, basically, because you are melting the permafrost, which then releases methane, which traps even more of the heat than carbon dioxide does. That we've kind of made it, we've made it a price of admission for the people who weren't as quick as we were to accept the way science works on this. We've kind of made it a cost of doing business for them to admit that they were wrong, to hang their heads and say they were wrong, and to want to join in the solution part. And the one reason why I would try to take the moral side of it out and just approach it in the level-headed way that Jerome is talking about is that the moral approach hasn't worked. And the changing our consumption patterns hasn't worked. That is why former Vice President Gore said we have to change laws, not light bulbs. So one thing that I would hope is that if we could somehow get it out of politics and even out of blame and just say, okay, we agree that this is how carbon dioxide keeps us all warmer. It's a, you know, we don't hold it against you that it took you longer to understand that. But now that we do understand it, what next?
And if we could somehow demonstrate that the path to solutions was advantageous.
So it's an uphill battle everywhere you go because, you know, people are motivated by greed and fear. And I think most of the people in your book, the deniers, are motivated by greed and fear.
It's just the greed part. And the fear that their greed wouldn't be satiated. So
you actually made it
the fear of unmet greed.
Yeah.
Right.
Wait, say again. Yeah.
You said you had trouble writing it, but you know, you made it humorous. That part was kind of humorous because it's so ridiculous that it's humorous.
They were very funny to write about. Because their greed was so naked, and then also they were ignoring solutions like the ones you're talking about, but their lies were so comically transparent. I remember that that S. Fred Singer, who a friend of mine thinks there should be operas about him because he lied about the ozone that Vanessa began this conversation with, and also lied about acid rain, lied about cigarettes, lied about the the cult, Reverend Moon's cult, the Moonies, and then most devastatingly lied about global warming, when they would come to him and say, here is irrefutable proof of sea level rise, he would pause for a millisecond and then say, the best research may be that it is a lowering of the land surface. And you have to just love somebody who will, you know, in the negative way that we love Darth Vader, you have to love a Darth Vader who is tripping over his own cape like S. Fred Singer. And Vanessa, okay. thank you for reading the book so well. Like that, though, I was being very sincere there. I was like, wow, that's exactly what the book is.
I wish it weren't true. Well, thank you so much, David Lipsky, for taking time out of your busy schedule teaching and writing to join us today.
I loved it, Vanessa. Thank you for the great conversation, Vanessa and Jerome.
Thank you. This was
wonderful, and there were things I'd never thought about. It was a pleasure listening to you both.
Our pleasure. David Lipsky's latest nonfiction book, which we discussed today, is called The Parrot and the Igloo, Climate and the Science of Denial, published by W.W. Norton and Company in 2023. As the New York Times book review Zoe Schlanger described it, David Lipsky spins top flight climate literature into cliffhanger entertainment.
It was such a hard thing to do, but I just wanted to make something while there are still beaches that we can go enjoy ourselves on. I wanted it to be something that you could read for fun, because it's a story that we're all living, and so the small thing that I could do, it isn't as big as the things that you and Jerome are doing, but it was something that was within my scope, and I thought I should do it just because we are all sharing the same small circle of land and water.
How can our listeners get in touch with you, David?
I suppose they could write to Norton. I don't have a website.
They can send you fan mail at your publisher.
Please. That would be a delight.
Thank you to our listeners for joining us today. I'm your host, Vanessa Harmony of Colorado Edible Forest in Glenwood Springs, Colorado, joined by my co-host, Jerome Osentowski of Central Rocky Mountain Permaculture Institute in Basalt, Colorado. Tune in next month on KDNK on the third Monday of the month at 4 p.m. for another episode of Living Permaculture. We'll talk to you then.
Bye-bye.
Peace.